Government guidelines will soon recommend we eat less beef as part of an environmentally friendly diet. That government says beef is so unfriendly to the environment leads us to ask, should beef be banned?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 997th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Valparaiso who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Now, I have a question for you, of course.
Oh, okay.
The question is, should we ban beef? The government says it's environmentally unfriendly.
What would we eat?
Well,
you don't want to ban beef.
There you go. That's Dave. Folks, according to a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, cows are not good for the environment. They produce more gases and water pollution and use up more land and water per calorie than all other protein animals there are. Now, the United States Department of Agriculture Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee recommends we eat foods that are not only good for the human body, but also good for the environment. Consequent to this committee recommendation, the federal government's dietary guidelines, which govern school lunch and other federal food programs, will soon begin calling for less beef and more fruits and vegetables as part of an environmentally friendly diet. And finally, this from the Friends of the Earth. We need to make sure our diets are in alignment with our natural resources and the need to reduce climate change. With government, science, and environmental community aligned against the cow, we simply must ask, should beef be banned? Well, here to help us round up an answer or two, we have Nicolette Hyman. I was bound and determined to do it right, and so you knew I was going to do it wrong. Nicolette Hyman, who is the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Nicolette, welcome back. It's so good to have you back on the Food Chain.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Now, it's been a while. Let's see, you were on number 628 with husband Bill of Nyman.
Yes, I didn't remember the exact number, but I remember being on very well.
It was way back there. So you were back talking about the pleasure of growing grass-fed beef in a world that was kind of dominated by factory farm beef. And, mm-hmm. you know, the world was kind of going against you at the time because – the environmental community of which you are a part, you know, was starting to look at beef as being a problem. And today, you know, some couple hundred Saturdays later, here you are with a book called Defending Beef. So, you know, that's quite a journey. And it, are you, do you have a notion that you're kind of like General Custer at the greasy grass?
I haven't thought of it like that. But you know, it's interesting because by the title of the book, there are people, some of my best friends included in this, who've thought, oh wow, have you kind of reversed your positions? Because I've been working on issues related to the livestock industry, you know, first as an environmental lawyer for Bobby Kennedy Jr. in New York, and then later as a writer and an advocate and a speaker and all this stuff. And, you know, everything I do is about sort of trying to reform current practices. Mm-hmm. And so some people have seen the book and without looking at it, but just looking at the title, they think, oh my gosh, you've kind of abandoned your previous efforts. And really, it's not that way at all. It's really, to me, just the next logical step because it's a result. The book Defending Beef is a result of me just having spent a lot, you know, more than a decade now, really learning, studying, and learning firsthand about how sort of the most sustainable food production takes place.
Well, I have a quick question I'd like to ask you, Nicolette, if I might. Because, you know, I got to thinking about you. You were an environmental lawyer for Bobby Kennedy's Water Watch, Water Cares Alliance, I believe it was. you're a vegetarian, and you're driving down the highway of life, the freeway, and all of a sudden you slam on your brakes and say, by golly, I'm going to write a book called Defending Beef. There must have been some moment there.
It really didn't happen like that. It was actually much more, there were no brake slammings, because it was much more of a gradual realization. I was hired by Bobby Kennedy to be the senior attorney for Waterkeeper Alliance in 2000. So that's now, you know, like 14 years ago. And at that time, I had already been a lawyer for the National Wildlife Federation. I've already been working full-time in environmental issues. And my major in college was biology, so I had a long interest in and involvement in the natural world and biological systems and so forth. And what happened when Bobby hired me, he asked me to work full-time on the issue of livestock production as an environmental matter. And that's what I did when I worked for him for 2 years. And it was during that time that I began spending a lot of times on visiting farms and ranches around the United States. And I began to see that there was a very dramatically different environmental impact depending on how things were done. And that, you know, if you fast forward to this most recent committee that's making this recommendation to USDA, I wholeheartedly agree with their notion that we should be thinking about food issues and environmental issues together. But what I have a problem with is the idea that you can do these broad brush stroke type recommendations. And in particular, obviously, I'm interested in what they're saying about beef, because not only do we raise beef here on the ranch that I live on and that I'm a part of, but also I've just written this book, Defending Beef. So I'm really thinking and particularly focused on beef. But really, it's true for all foods. There's a dramatically different environmental impact depending on how it's done. So whenever you put a whole category of foods into, you know, good or bad environmentally, that's just overly simplified, and it's actually kind of absurd.
Now, of course, we have to ask, you are a vegetarian. Are you still a vegetarian?
Yes, and you know, people have asked about that a lot, especially because I've written this book. And the only thing I can say about it is I think I can show how strongly I believe how helpful beef is as a food, because we have two young sons, both under the age of 6, that I feed beef to on a very regular basis, and butter and, you know, other bovine products. But I've been a vegetarian for over 25 years, and it's just kind of the diet I'm comfortable with. So I haven't had the desire to eat beef yet, although if I do, I will certainly eat it.
You'll know where to get it, right? Well, this is very interesting, because here we have an environmental attorney of long standing in the environmental community. Here we have a vegetarian, and here we have the author of a book, Defending Beef. Now, I guess I could see where your friends would fall out of their chair when you showed them the book, because that's quite an existential leap, because cows are bad. We all know cows are bad. The government tells us cows are bad. The scientific community tells us cows are bad. The environmental community tells us cows are bad. And yet here's Nicolette Nyman saying, no, it's not like that.
Well, in fact, that's the whole point of the book. It's that we've all come to accept these ideas as conventional wisdom now. And the argument of the book is we really need to re-examine this idea. It's actually just become kind of an assumption. In fact, what's been really interesting to me in response to the book, I've seen a number of people having this very knee-jerk reaction. You know, Roots of Change, which is a wonderful organization that does, you know, great work. I'm sure you're familiar with them. Does a lot of work about kind of trying to make the agricultural system more environmentally sustainable. They've had some things on their Facebook page about my book and spoken very favorably about it. And some of the people commenting who had never seen the book just wrote, unfollowing.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like you can't even say this. This is, you know, you're challenging what has become the orthodoxy.
So you're apostate then, right?
So it's just exactly. It's like you're saying something that is, you know, heresy. You're not even supposed to say this. So what I'm doing is I'm saying, hold on, let's actually look at the facts. Let's look at the science. And what I think the book really shows is that when you do things well, grazing animals are not only not damaging, but they're actually an essential part of optimally functioning food systems. Because what I'm arguing is that we have to think in much bigger terms, and we need to try to think about human activities, and especially agriculture, because it affects so much of the world's lands. We need to think about functioning in a way that's like an ecosystem.
Well, that's going to be a good one to come back to. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Nicolette Nyman, who is the author of Defending Beef. She, the environmental attorney and vegetarian, who's standing up and defending beef against the government, science, the environmental community, but not me, because I happen to like beef. When we come back, I want to start this conversation by asking what your opinion is of exactly what does the government want us to eat by virtue of what it says and by virtue of what it subsidizes. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, Nicolette Nyman, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-4791080. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Put down that big, juicy cheeseburger, ladies and gentlemen, because the government wants you to eat less beef and more environmentally friendly foods like, well, like what, Nicolette?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, when you look at the demographic data about what Americans have been eating for the last several decades, I do this in a lot of detail in my book. It's actually not the way people think it is. We've been dramatically decreasing our red meat consumption for the last few decades. Beef is down by about 25%, for example, and lamb, you know, is way down. And, you know, if you sort of look at all the red meats, it's kind of declined, and egg consumption is down. Animal fat consumption is way down. And you know what we're eating more of? We're eating a lot more vegetable fat and a lot more grain-based foods, flour-based foods, and things like, you know, think donut, think bagel. We're eating a lot more sugar. And so those, to me, are really clearly the culprits in the rise in modern chronic diseases, and that needs to be the focus of what, you know, the government and everybody else should be telling us that we should be reducing. It's ironic to me that we're talking about saying people shouldn't be eating beef, because when you look at the demographic data, there's absolutely no connection between the amount of beef people are eating and the rise in chronic diseases. In fact, the total amount that people are eating today is very similar. It's almost exactly the same to what they were eating in 1900, when only about 8% of people were dying from heart attacks. About 42% of people are dying from heart attacks. The deaths, I should say, every year are from heart attacks. And so to say that this has anything to do with beef or red meat consumption is actually kind of ridiculous, just looking at the demographic data.
So in essence, it's really not the beef. Now, what is government telling us to eat by virtue of what it subsidizes?
Well, this is an interesting sort of paradox. They do say, like in these recommendations that are being talked about right now in Washington, there's encouragement to reduce sugar. That's great. I'm totally in favor of that. Although they're talking about a recommendation of 10% of your diet, which is actually still way too much. And they're talking about people increasing their vegetable and fruit consumption. That's great. I agree with that. But ironically, the subsidies don't have anything to do with that. We subsidize, as a nation, we subsidize the sugar industry very heavily. We subsidize the high fructose corn syrup industry because we subsidize corn. And we don't subsidize fruits and vegetables at all. So there's almost no connection between what the recommendations say about what we should be eating and what farming and agricultural policy
is. It's kind of like the parent that tells a kid, now, kid, do as I say and not as I do.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, there are a lot of problems. I'm glad these things are being discussed in Washington. I'm just not sure. I think they're taking a few wrong turns, you know, in where they're going on this. But, the good news is at least this is being talked about, because we've had this problem since about the 1950s. I mean, in the 1950s, that was when you began to see the development of a lot of agricultural policy that was deliberately intended to focus on increasing production. And that happened, and especially with respect to grain production, grain and soy production began to rise quite dramatically as a result of government subsidies. And that's actually when you began to see more and more of the kind of concentrated animal production, for example, because grains were so cheap that it made it really economically feasible to create these giant feedlots and these giant hog and poultry confinement operations. So I think it's great that that stuff is being reexamined, but the idea of just sort of categorically saying, for example, beef is not something people should be eating because it's bad for the environment, that is oversimplifying the issue. That's exactly the whole point of my book, is to attack that kind of thinking.
Well, it seems as though that technology that allowed us to increase production of the grains allowed us to turn grass-eating cows into grain-eating cows.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's been done. You know, one of the things that's important is people, you know, the issues just get so oversimplified again and again. And I really like Michael Pollan's work and his writings, and I like him as a person. But he's been one of these people that, you know, my husband and I have both periodically talked with him about being careful about not oversimplifying this issue too much. Because there's nothing wrong with some use of grains for livestock, including cattle. And ever since the Middle Ages, when cattle were, you know, people have been, you know, domesticated cattle, you know, 12,000 years ago, and they've been keeping them over the winter using some grains. That is completely normal. And that, there's nothing wrong with doing that. There's nothing wrong with the animal getting that, and it might be the best use of resources from an ecological standpoint to do that. The problem is, starting around the middle of the 20th century, you began to have sort of what I would characterize as a misuse of grains to what we would say grow animals on grain, the grass-eating animals, who really should be optimizing these grasslands that are out there, both, you know, because it increases the ecosystem function, like I mentioned before, and because it's basically non-usable vegetation. What humans can't eat it, very few animals can, actually.
Take us back, speaking of oversimplifying, take us back to the magic of the cow and grass.
Yeah, that's kind of at the fundamental, it's at the heart of my book. So what's so amazing about the ruminant animal, the cattle being part of that group, is that they have these multi-chambered digestive tracts, which are very complex. It's very different than the human digestive tract. And what they're able to do through this, you know, the whatever they consume going through these various stages in their digestive tracts, is they're able to, with the assistance of a bunch of microorganisms that live in their digestive tracts, they're actually able to convert vegetation, basically just think of grass as a great example.
Cellulose.
It doesn't really have any nutrition for most animals. And most animals cannot survive off of it. Certainly the human cannot. But the ruminant is able, with the assistance of these microorganisms, to convert just basically cellulosic vegetation, like grass, into nourishment. That's very unique in the animal kingdom. And that's what makes the grazing animal so unique, because they can populate the grasslands of the world, and they can eat just that and survive. And that's what's magical about cattle. And actually, that's why cattle have been, and goats, have been so important in the history of humanity, because we've been able to go into parts of the world where you couldn't grow much else And yet these ruminant animals were with us and allowed us to have meat and milk as part of the diet. They were just eating grass. And that's the beauty of the cattle. And that's why, you know, a lot of why sort of universally condemning them is so absurd.
Something that allowed us to survive on Earth in places that we would not have survived is all of a sudden becoming something very bad. And to kind of scratch your head at it, if you think about it, if you look back and take a real long look at human history, that cows have all of a sudden become very bad. Wait a minute, what is going on here? But there is something that is going on here, because we have changed the ways we have raised cows. We've taken them off the grass. We've taken them away from the grasslands and move them into feedlots, and that's the difference, right?
Yes. Well, it's important, again, to keep this in a global context. So, first of all, I want to step back into prehistory for just a second, and it's very important to remember that the Earth was once covered with these grazing animals, not the domesticated cattle, obviously, but animals that functioned in a very similar way. So if you think about these huge caribou herds that continue to exist up in the Arctic, or if you think about the giant bison herds that were once in the Great Plains of the Americas, or if you think about the Cape Buffalo and the Serengeti, those are tiny remnants of the herds that once covered the globe. And so that's a very important fact to keep in mind, because for millions of years, these ecosystems evolved, everything from the microorganisms in the soil to the vegetation, and then the animals that depend on those, the insect life and everything, you know, bigger than that, evolved over millions of years with the presence of these huge grazing animals. Now you fast forward to today.
Wait a minute, you can't fast forward anywhere because we have to take a break. Doggone it. But we will fast forward when we get back. And,
okay.
This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Nicolette Nyman, who is the author of Defending Beef. She, the environmental attorney, vegetarian. Now, did meeting up with a handsome rancher have anything to do with your conversion?
Well,
don't answer
it
that
certainly
question.
Has helped.
Right back. Do stay tuned. Bad, bad cow. Well, at least that's what the government is telling us. And not only government, but the environmental community and science and everybody else, but not Nicolette Nyman. No, no, no. She says cows can be very good. You know, Nicolette, Joel Salatin out there in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia maintains that the great forests that have overwhelmed the East Coast were consequent to getting rid of all the grazing animals, and that the landscape there should be a savanna instead of a deeply forested.
And well, that's something I talk about in my book, is that people have the impression that the entire globe, before humans became, you know, so populated all over the globe, was basically forested, and that is completely untrue. The first evidence of grass pollen is dated to right around the same time that the dinosaurs disappeared, so something like 60 million years ago. And it was only a few million years after that that grasslands covered much of the globe. And it's from that time forward that we've had this sort of symbiotic relationship between grazing animals and grasslands, because as Joel suggests, and he's read my book, he did a blurb for my book actually, he's very correct in pointing out that these large herds maintained these grasslands, and that they continued to exist because you had this this sort of co-evolution between the grasslands and the grazing animals and the predators that kept those grazing animals on the move and densely congregated.
And the people who lived there at the time were the indigenous peoples, or Native Americans, or Indians, or whatever they're called these days. They had a way of managing the landscape to encourage the grasslands and discourage the undergrowth, right?
Well, in fact, what's interesting, I kind of go through this whole history in my book. The humans only arrived in the Americas quite recently as far as, you know, populating the globe. It was about 13,000 years ago, it's believed. That's debated, but it's right around that time probably. And many of the large animals that had once covered the Americas had already disappeared by the time humans arrived. They don't know why that happened. There's debate about that, probably climactic changes. But there were still substantial herds, and it's believed that probably human overhunting caused the disappearance of a lot of the remaining large animals. But then what began to happen was the native peoples that began, you know, populating the Americas about 13,000 years ago began to actively manage the landscape through fire, especially in order to keep these large open spaces that had once been created by the presence of these huge grazing animals. And because they were increasingly disappearing, especially when humans began to overhunt them, they needed to be maintained through burning. So this is the thing that's so strange about the modern environmental movement. We never look at this long-term history. We just look at the last 100 years, or maybe we think of 1,000 years or something, but we don't think about the fact that we had millions of years of evolution of these huge animals covering the globe, and then only very recently have they disappeared. That's why the cattle are so important, because they serve as a proxy for those disappeared grazing animals.
Wow. And there it is. So let's go to the environmental community. What is it? The United Nations came out with a report called Livestock's Long Shadow, saying that cows are responsible for 18% of the greenhouse gases in the world.
Well, now, wait. That's important to be precise about that. I talk about the report in a lot of detail in my book. Okay. Their statement was that 18% of the world's global warming gases are caused by all livestock. So that includes cattle. But that was not attributed to cattle.
Okay, but cattle being the convenient whipping boy, as it were, there
yeah,
they
that's
are.
True. They absolutely, they argue kind of strenuously in that report, that was from 2006, that the number of cattle should be reduced.
You know, as an environmental attorney who worked, you know, in the East Coast Power Corridor, I have to ask this question. Do you ever think that these reports are used for political purposes, and that the information they impart therefore get kind of skewed to enforce those purposes?
Well, the unfortunate thing is, you know, the science in that report is perfectly fine. I don't have any problem with the data that they rely on. It's where they make the recommendations, and then the way, even worse, the way it's been used in the popular dialogue. So let's look at that just a little bit. First of all, the report, as I just mentioned, said that for the whole globe, there was an 18% global warming impact. Now, in 2013, so just last, the year before last now, they reduced that number down to 14%. So they themselves changed the number downward. And yet everybody still uses the 18% number. But also, they included some things in there that I don't believe should ever have been included in that figure. So they said that, for example, the deforestation happening in Indonesia and Sudan and Brazil that could be connected to cattle production was part of this figure. Now, that's really debatable, because when you talk about, for example, cattle raising in the United States, which is the vast majority of it is entirely done in the United States. I mean, the beef that people are consuming today, more than 80% of it comes entirely from the U.S. And then of that 16% that's imported, over 80% of that comes from Canada, Mexico, and Australia. So the connection between American beef, what Americans are eating, and the Sudan and Indonesia and Brazil is almost nothing.
Well, in Brazil, they're burning down the forest to plant soybeans.
Well, and that's another element of it. I wrote an op-ed about this whole issue for the New York Times a few years ago called The Carnivore's Dilemma. And when you look at it, it's really crop production, and especially soy production, that is much more immediately responsible for this. And actually, in Brazil, people talk about the rainforest and Amazon all the time being a problem related to American beef production. There's almost none of it coming here at all. But even if that were still an issue, it's been reduced by over 80% over the last decade. The New York Times just did a big article about that a few days ago. So that's kind of a non-issue. People have it in their minds as a big issue. When you talk to American environmentalists, they bring that up over and over again. The facts don't support that. It's just simply untrue. And then the other big problem with that livestock's long shadow number, which again, you know, now it's really been reduced down to 14% by the UN itself, but it has very little to do with American beef production. So the total agricultural global warming impact, according to the United States Environmental Protection Agency, for this country is about 8%. That's all of agriculture. And all of the ruminant animals, so all the goats, sheep, and cattle combined, are just about a quarter of that. And so the total impact is about 2% on global warming gases in the United States. So people really have to remember that. That's the real number.
So the ports really do are held up and used as a political tool as well. You know, there's three things in the element of global warming gases that you talk about: carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. So when we come back, we'll like to go through them really quickly because you do an excellent presentation on refuting them. But it's the image of a cow and laughing gas that has me stuck. So when we get back, we'll work that through. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Nicola Nyman, who is the author of Defending Beef. Do you think beef needs to be defending? What do you think? Do you think we should get rid of it? Of all the cows, you think global warming will end if we get rid of all of our cows? 800-624-2665, 831-4790. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, Nicola Nyman, and you do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. The government and science and the environmental community say cows are bad because they increase global warming, and we're all going to cook if we don't get rid of cows or something like that, but I don't know about that. Nicola Nyman seems to think that's not the case if we do things right. The objection, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. What's wrong with all of those pollutants that cows are making? Nicolette.
Yeah, well, especially when you're talking about cattle, the focus is especially on the methane, and that's absolutely true. When you actually look at, you know, every stage of production and so forth, that's really the issue. There's very little carbon dioxide problem related to cattle production, and it's also true for nitrous oxide. There's some connection, but especially if the cattle are on grass, there's very little connection. So let's talk about the methane, because that's the real concern. The methane from cattle comes from the digestive processes, like we were talking about before. By the ruminant, which allows cattle to eat grass, this, you know, vegetation that pretty much nobody else can eat except for ruminant animals, that is kind of their blessing, and it also turns out to be their curse, because they have that very special process that happens in their bodies, they emit methane as part of that process. So there is truth to this concern. The question is this, you know, such a problem that we need to get rid of cattle? Well, I say a bunch of things. First of all, rice production, according to some scientists, was the single largest methane producer caused by humans in the 1980s.
How does rice produce methane?
How does it do it?
Yeah,
to do with the fact that rice is grown in very, very wet environments.
Okay.
And these swamps, you know, it has to do with the breakdown of the vegetation in the swamps where they're grown. I don't fully understand it, but it's the same sort of,
the swamps are probably the same as the ruminants' stomachs.
Well, exactly. It has to do with this, you know, the way the vegetation is cycled in the ecosystem that they're grown in. And so, there was a lot of attention put on this issue within the rice industry. And it was brought down pretty dramatically. The rice production today emits a lot less methane. So that's my first point is, you know, we never said let's get rid of rice because it causes methane. We said let's reduce the methane. The same thing should and, in fact, is happening with cattle. There's research happening at agricultural colleges all over the world, and a lot of things are being looked at. It's being found that, for example, if you rotate the cattle on the pasture more frequently, if they're on better quality feed in terms of the forage, all of that reduces the methane. It's also been found sort of obscure things like if you put little metal weights in the rumen of cattle, it reduces their methane emissions by 30%. Now, that's kind of a strange thing, and who knows if that'll ever become common practice. But the point is there are options. We can reduce the methane. And so that's a very important part of it. The other part of the issue is the fact that it's also being shown at agricultural colleges and other places around the world that having the grazing animals on these grasslands dramatically assists in the process of carbon sequestration, taking the carbon from the air and putting it into the soils. So the Union of Concerned Scientists did a big report looking at beef production in the United States a few years ago, and they noted that the total global warming impact of cattle was around 2%, like I said before, but that the potential for mitigating climate change was as much as 2% of the total global warming gases as well. So their report and a lot of other scientists as well have concluded that you might be able to fully offset all of that methane impact through massive carbon sequestration in the soils. So, you know, the issue is a lot more complex than people tend to think. And when you look at all of the benefits that these grazing animals provide, both to the ecosystems and to our food system by providing really nutrient-dense food, I think the argument that we should get rid of cattle just completely collapses.
So we kind of go from 18% to nothing, and furthermore, we get to turn all of that wonderful, worthless grass into nutrient-rich food that we can eat.
Exactly, because, you know, it may or may not be possible to offset all of the global warming gases from cattle. There are some people who think it is possible. Others say it's not. But to me, I don't even think that that is necessary. That's not the bottom line question. The bottom line question is, overall, are the benefits outweighed by the detriment? And when in my book, I talk about, you know, my specialty when I was an environmental lawyer was water quality. And when you look at the way soils are generated and protected, the way water is generated and protected by various different land uses, the optimal situation for protecting groundwater and surface waters is densely vegetated land that is not plowed. And the only way we can produce food from that is with these grazing animals. And in fact, they maintain those grasslands. They help those grasslands when they're well managed. So it's actually a very important part of a sustainable food system.
Well, so much, you know, is being done to study the impact of grazing on the landscape. And so much is of our attention is being redirected from those cattle feedlots into free-range grazing or grass-fed beef and whatnot. I guess kind of according to the gospel of Alan Savory and you folks are working really hard at redirecting our attention to that. But when we come back from this very last break, I have to ask you the big question. You've got the federal government, you've got the scientific community, you've got the environmentalists, all intent on raging war on the cow here. I mean, they're going to come out with dietary guidelines for school lunches that say, eat less beef. They're going to come out and start preaching this gospel to everybody. Now, do you have enough, you know, to stand up to that withering broadside from all of these people and save the cow? So that's the question we're going to put on the table to Nicolette Nyman when we get back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Please do stay tuned for the conclusion.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids. But the college years at UC Davis were the big years, because what we learned there, we brought home. Today, we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
What do you think out there? Governments tells you what to think, and it tells you to think about eating less beef because it's not friendly to the environment. Nicolette Nyman thinks otherwise, and in spite of being an environmental attorney, a vegetarian, she writes a book called Defending Beef. And it's a case for sustainable meat production. So, you know, the question is, can you do this in a way to satisfy all of those people who simply just want to get rid of the cow?
Well, I think there's actually a very simple first step that should really be looked at. I've been sort of in my speaking I've been doing about this book, I've been encouraging people to think about contacting our governor who's really interested in reducing global warming impact. to just make it part of the plan that we direct some of our resources towards improving grazing practices. Because people think when I, you know, talk about my book or when they just sort of glance at my book, they assume I'm trying to say we all need to be raising totally grass-fed beef. But the truth of the matter is, there are cattle all over California and all over the United States, but a lot of them in this state that are either dairy cattle or they are beef cattle that end up in feedlots in the Midwest, but they're on the grass for much of their lives. The mother cows are always on grass, the bulls are on grass, the calves are on grass, and a lot of yearling cattle are on grass before they go to feedlots. So if we just look at improving grazing practices, this goes back to what I was talking about before, this carbon sequestration issue, I think we can actually have a pretty dramatic beneficial impact on global warming, on water quality, on building soil for the future. There are a lot of things that would come, and very positive things that would come from just having better management of the cattle that are out there today. So that sounds, you know, I hope, like a very feasible step that could take place.
That's step number one. What's step number two?
Well, I think step number two is there should be a migration away from grain feeding. I don't think that over the long term that is the optimal way to raise cattle, either dairy cattle or beef cattle, because, you know, actually 75% of the world's cattle are totally grass-fed. But in the United States, there's more grain feeding happening here than in most parts of the world. And producing the grain is really the environmental problem. It's water-intensive. It causes a lot of pollution, nutrient pollution, especially from the fertilizer that's applied. And we need to move away from that. So I think ultimately the shift should be toward grass, away from grain. But in the immediate sense, we can just work on improving grazing practices, and that will have a dramatic improvement.
What can we consumers do to affect that change?
Well, I think the consumer can seek out dairy and beef products that are, you know, hopefully regionally or locally produced. In California, there is a lot of dairy and beef production, so this is entirely possible. I've met people raising, especially totally grass-based dairy and beef animals all over the state of California. So anyone who wants to actually can find it locally. And, you know, often, you know, you had these wonderful things in between our segments, and you were talking about farmers markets in there and also cooking wonderful beef stew. Things that were great to hear about. But that's absolutely true. That's a great place to find locally produced meat.
If we consumers really want good food and healthy food and food for the environment, it's our responsibility to affect that change by buying that kind of food, and the rest will take care of it. And furthermore, we could tell the government to quit spending our money growing things that we don't want. How's that for an idea? Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Nicolette Hahn. The book, Defending Beef. Go pick it up. Learn a little bit about the cow and the environment and yourself. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.